Hello, I'm Terry Walls. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, and I'm here today to talk with you about food as medicine. And the first thing I'd say is I'm very pleased to see all of you are eating vegetables and that there are green vegetables on your plates. You'll hear more about why that's so important. Okay, so why do I have so much passion about food as medicine? Part of it has to do with my own personal experience. I have secondary progressive MS, and beginning in 2003, I needed a scooter and then a tilt-recline wheelchair. By 2007, I could walk short distances with two canes and use my tilt-recline wheelchair for distances more than 10 feet. And in November 1, I started the use of electrical stimulation of my muscles and a very intensive nutritional program that I designed to provide nutritional support for energy production in mitochondria, neurotransmitter production, myelin production. The result was actually quite dramatic. 4 months after starting that intervention, I no longer used my cane even. I was walking throughout the hospital. And by September of the following fall, I was able to bicycle 18 miles in a bicycle fundraiser. So having that experience of viscerally seeing what a difference intensive nutrition could make, I began to use some of these nutritional concepts in my practice, which includes the VA Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic and in primary care. And I use these in dealing with people who have severe psychiatric disturbances, depression, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, dementia, the usual primary care things that I'm sure you guys are seeing, which has to do with high blood pressure, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, chronic lung disease, and again, with very significant results. So over and over again, you and I hear that the scientists are finding the genes responsible for diseases. So one might think the reason we have such an epidemic in the healthcare crisis has to do with somehow this rapid mutation that we're experiencing, such that we have over a quarter of our children in schools having severe enough psychological problems that they're on an antidepressant or a stimulant for the ADD, or they're on serious behavior programs related to disruptive behaviors in the classroom. But we're Iowans here, and we know about corn, so do a thought experiment with me. Take a bag of seed corn, plant half of it in the good black Iowa dirt, put some fertilizer on it, and we'll come back in the fall for the harvest. The other half we take out to the trash heap, which we sort of spread out, even out, and now we plant that, no fertilizer, and we come back in the fall. The black dirt corn is going to be tall, you know, brilliant green, packed with corn, a bumper crop which now is probably about 180 bushels an acre. The trash heap corn is going to be stunted, it'll be yellow, it'll be sickly, it'll be filled with fungal infections, a lot of smut, probably a lot of cutworm. You'll be lucky to find any ears of corn, and the ones that you do will be very small nubbins with very few kernels of corn. It was the same DNA in both fields. So what's the difference? Nutrition, yes. The DNA in the black dirt had everything that it needed. The DNA in the trash heap did not. This is a wonderful study, and I'd recommend it very highly. Dr. Weston Price, who is a dentist, observed that the dental health of his practice was abysmal. The children had very crooked teeth. The attack rate for cavities approached 95%. And he wanted to know why the dental health was so abysmal. So we did something that's actually quite brilliant. He assembled a multidisciplinary team consisting of anthropologists, nutritionists, dental personnel, medical personnel, mental health personnel, and some soil scientists. And they went around the globe to 14 different indigenous peoples and did a very careful diet history, examined them, took pictures of their faces, x-rays of the dental arch, mental assessments, psychological assessments, physical assessments, and the medical history. Then they analyzed the data according to whether or not the individual was eating a primitive diet, a first-generation westernized diet or a second-generation westernized diet. And they did a nutritional analysis of the foodstuffs, and they did a soil analysis of the local soil. So if you're having a Western diet, it was a pretty traditional Western diet that you and I would recognize. A lot of meat, a bunch of potatoes, white flour, and a bunch of sugar. Very few fruits, very few vegetables. It did not meet the minimum recommendations for vitamins or minerals. It was did not meet the recommendations for essential fatty acids. Those individuals had crooked teeth. The attack rate was 50 to 80% for dental caries. The psychological health was declined, and the physical health was declined. The second generation, the teeth were more severely crooked, and the decline in mental health and physical health was even greater. The incidence of diabetes, heart disease, and rheumatoid arthritis was greater. Now, the primitive diets were quite radical. The Eskimos ate something quite different than the Africans, than the folks in the remote Swiss Alps or the Aborigines. So people had adapted their local foodstuffs to their region. But they were remarkably consistent that they were very high in micronutrients. So they had 3 to 6 times what we'd consider the recommended daily allowance for vitamins and minerals now. They had 3 to 6 times, or actually twice of what we consider the recommended minimum for omega-3s as well. And the teeth were straight. They also have a number of photographs where same parents, first the oldest kids were born on a primitive, eating a primitive diet, then they got westernized, and the later kids were eating a western diet, and now the kids have crooked teeth and perform more poorly on the physical and psychological assessment. So his conclusion was a primitive diet led to superior physical fitness and superior mental health. It was also his conclusion that in the absence of micronutrients, physical deterioration of the species occurs quite rapidly. He predicted a rapid decline in the physical and mental health of the primitive peoples that he studied as their diets became westernized. He also predicted a rapid decline in the fertility rates and the physical health of the westernized societies. This remarkable study was done in 1936. And I'll submit that back in 1936, the average Western diet was still considerably healthier than the average Western diet today. Epigenetics is the medical term that I believe explains this and explains the cornfield scenario that I presented earlier. That is that we know the genes turn on and off based on the environment. So based on the toxins of the environment and the micronutrients present, parts of the DNA will be methylated, that is blocked so they cannot be expressed. And there's an increasing recognition that the disease state is a reflection of the genes that we have, but more importantly, the micronutrients and the toxins that are allowing us to express which genes. Which leads to the question, how much restoration of health can we get by correcting the micronutrient deficiencies and minimizing or removing the toxins? Okay, so quick reminder. You guys all know that we have trillions of cells in our body, and in each instant we have trillions of biochemical reactions that are going on. If you reach back to biochemistry, you might even remember a few of them. What I never learned, and still is not being taught, is how many of those substrates are essential, that is, we have to eat them, that they cannot be manufactured, that if they are not present, your body's left with either improvising by substituting an incorrect molecule, making an incorrect product, or the reaction simply not happening whatsoever. The cross-linking that occurs in our arteries, hardening the elastin in our arteries, is a reflection of lacking the proper substrates. Okay, so another thing that we've probably forgotten is that within the year, 98% of the atoms within your body will have been swapped out. Your skin will have been swapped out many times, the lining in the gut about 52 times, the solid organs 2 to 3 times. I can't give you the stats on the brain. No one quite knows how much we swap out there. We used to think that the brain could not repair itself. We have now come to realize that, in fact, the brain does continually remodel, repair. So there is far more repair capability even in the brain. Okay, so the pharmaceuticals that you and I study all the time and hopefully master will block certain abnormal parts of our physiology. What we have not studied, certainly I did not, and I know we are not teaching that adequately, is how we can ensure that we have all those substrates for those normal physiologic reactions by understanding our true micronutrient needs. Okay, so chronic disease, that's the life and blood of internal medicine. It's much of the life and blood of everyone in primary care. If you ask me, okay, so what precisely is the cause of hypertension, of type 2 diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis, we sort of fumble around and realize that there's a complex interplay of my DNA, the toxic exposures that I might have, the allergies that may be going on, the infections to which I've been exposed, the amount of stress, physical activity, and the amount of learning that I have that will add up to the severity of the disease and which diseases are going to be expressed. Okay, so quick reminder, biochemistry, I won't torture you guys too much more beyond this. Hopefully you remember, when we make energy, if we could only do the energy production that we're capable of in the cytosol, which is two ATP molecules out of that glucose molecule, would all be bacteria. You only get to be one cell in size. As soon as you begin to have more effective bioenergetics, as in mitochondria, or if you're a plant, as in chloroplasts, then the cell is now efficient enough that it can grow and become a multicellular organism. And the difference is between 2 ATP per glucose versus 38 ATP. Mm-hmm. Now, you add to that the fact that the cell, if you're a brain cell, you can put in thousands of mitochondria in that cell. Or if you're a cardiac cell, you can put in thousands of mitochondria in that myocyte. Now you're comparing a snail with a fighter jet. That's the difference in energy efficiency. So one of the most helpful things we can do is help our patients understand how to see to it their mitochondria have everything they need to be in tip-top shape. Okay, so let's go back. Remember a few of these molecules, the FADH, that comes from riboflavin, which is B2. NADH comes from niacinamide, which is B3. And the electron transport chain relies heavily on ubiquinone, which is coenzyme Q10. I memorized this, and you probably did too, using glucose as the entry molecule, but if you have enough lipoic acid and carnitine, you can bring in free fatty acids and increase your substrates for the mitochondria. Okay, another picture about how all that works. I should remind you that the mitochondria is a chemical plant. Like all chemical plants, it's going to have a little bit of trash at the end. And if we don't get rid of that trash, the free radicals will build up, destroy the membranes on the mitochondria, and knock out the mitochondria, or worse yet, go to the nucleus and begin knocking out parts of the nuclear DNA. So the defense against those free radicals are going to be the antioxidants that are immediately available. Some of that is vitamin C, vitamin E, are popular antioxidants, but we're beginning to realize that many of the phytonutrients are even more potent than vitamin C and vitamin E. Things such as resveratrol, quercetin. I'll come back to that again. Okay, so what is health? Most of us have forgotten what health really is. We probably see it so rarely anymore. And many of us have probably experienced it so rarely that we have forgotten what that is. It comes back biochemically to the optimal functioning of all of those trillions of biochemical reactions that need to happen. For example, I'm sure all of you have heard of Linus Pauling, the nut who was so big in vitamin C, said it would cure everything. I used to think he was a nut too. I'm not quite so convinced about it anymore. He's a biochemist. Has gotten the Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel Prize for biochemistry. He observed that primates are one of the and I believe guinea pigs are the two mammals that do not make vitamin C. Everyone else does, and most plants do as well. The amount of vitamin C that a 70-kilogram mammal would make in a typical day would be 10 grams. Now, at the time that this defect probably developed in our history, primates were still eating primarily green leaves and a few smaller mammals that they could catch. At that time, the dietary consumption of vitamin C would have been 8 to 12 grams a day. Hence, we were fine without that vitamin C in our DNA. And Linus Pauling presumed that if we would go back to eating a diet that included 10 grams of vitamin C, the vigor of our species, the vigor of our health would be greatly improved. Okay. Quick reminder, standard American diet. I like to call it SAD. Because it is. So we're very low on omega-3. Less than 10% of us have a sufficient amount of omega-3s to meet our needs, and omega-3s I will talk more about. Key thing, think brain and the cell walls, cell membranes. We are relatively devoid of vitamins and minerals. I believe less than 10% meet all of our requirements through food of our identified vitamins. Less than 70% are eating enough of our iodine. I've been telling my patients for years, quit using all that table salt. It's bad for your high blood pressure. But remember, North America is iodine deficient, and we get our iodine mostly through iodized salt. So when our patients quit using iodized salt, they no longer have enough iodine. In the 1980s, the food industry used to iodate their food, and they switched to bromine, which does has at some degree have some toxicities associated with it. You had a question?
Is there any other source of iodine besides food?
Yes, we will talk about it. But right now, the other sources for iodine include seaweed, dried kelp, sea salt, and shellfish. Seafood is a very good source of that. Then, of course, we have lots of white flour and lots of sugar. So the result of this shift away from the green leaves, bright colors, to a grain-based diet led to increase of insulin need, increased amounts of circulatory cytokines, increased inflammation, central obesity, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes. Okay. So just a very quick comment on the obesity-starvation connection. When the brain can sense that we've had all the micronutrients necessary for our mitochondria to work entirely well, we are much more likely to turn our appetite rheostat down. If, on the other hand, what the brain senses is that our mitochondria are not operating efficiently because we don't have as much of our FADH and ADH or enough of our ubiquinone to handle all of the free radicals, we're still hungry. Our brain is now recognizing that we're short on antioxidants. We will have craving, particularly for sweet things, because you would have 50,000 years ago, when you're looking for antioxidants, going out looking for strawberries, raspberries, blueberries. And unfortunately, in the SAD diet, we interpret that as an attack for a blizzard or some other sweet confections. The brain also continues to drive the hunger because if you're not having enough of your micronutrients, and your mitochondria are not performing well, so you continue to be hungry as well. Add to that, which is, I don't think, on the slides here. Okay, we'll come back. So add to that the issue that the food industry very clearly understands that dopamine elevates in response to food, also to sex, by the way, these very important things that need to happen for the species to continue. And by manipulating the content of our diet, the salt, sugar, and fat content, you can cause a more rapid rise in glucose and a more rapid raise in dopamine. which will result in craving and addictive type behaviors. And if you look at our public health issues, we now have created, through our fast food industry, a large segment of our population that has very addictive behaviors around their food, which they know they should not be consuming. They know it's bad for them, bad for their diabetes, bad for their arthritis, but they're unable to help themselves. Very typical of addictive behavior. Okay, so inflammation. Inflammation, we are recognizing, is a very common part of more and more of the disease states. We see that, of course, in diabetes, metabolic syndrome. We're seeing that in atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease. We're now also seeing it in mental health arenas. Inflammation, bipolar, schizophrenia, all have evidence of inflammatory cytokines as a large factor driving those processes. Oxidative stress and free radical damage, which is a reflection of mitochondria that have not been sufficiently powered with their nutrient substrates. So this high damage from free radicals are also being seen in more and more diseases. Our autoimmune diseases, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, GERD, the mental health diseases, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, autism. So we have inflammation, which worsened by consuming a diet that's high in high glycemic food, high in sugars, white flours, white potatoes. And we see the problems with a diet that is pro-inflammatory, same kind of high sugar, high white flour diet, will stress your mitochondria, increasing your free radical generation, worsening these chronic diseases that you and I see in our practices day in and day out. Okay, so when I'm seeing my patients with diabetes, my treatment choices are, you know, traditionally I'm going to pull out my pharmacology stuff. I'll begin glyburide or metformin. I may or may not have to begin insulin. If they're here for their arthritis or their asthma, sometimes we need to use oral steroids, NSAIDs. So I give a variety of drugs to try and slow down some of the disease processes. What we have not done very creatively is to look at how we can teach people to change their diet so their body needs less insulin. If you compare the diet that was eaten 50,000 years ago, which was green leaves and fruits, eggs in the spring when you could catch them, and the diet that we have now, the diet that's largely plant-based needs very little insulin to maintain a steady state for the blood sugars. The diet that we eat, our SAD diet, needs a very high level of insulin. So one of the possibilities for treating our diabetics could be educating them on the power of shifting their diet so we need to consume less insulin to maintain that steady state blood sugar. Okay, so kinds of things to do, sort of like, well, I've got to be smoking something. My patients would never, ever make those kind of radical changes. You know, and I used to think that as well until I started doing this in my practice. And, you know, I see a lot of guys who have very severe psychiatric problems, severe PTSD, bipolar, who have pretty marginal social skills because they've been through such terrible strains of war. And yet when I take the time to teach them the biology, show them how mitochondria work and that what their cells need for optimal function, I've been changed. They will, in fact, understand the message and make radical changes based on what is really a 10-minute conversation. So I end up talking about the importance of how the micronutrients are needed for the cells to work, for all those biochemical reactions to happen. As we have an ongoing relationship, I may also talk about issues related to gut health and the bacteria that reside in our gut and need to introduce probiotics or fermented foods as well. But I always start first with teaching them what are the micronutrients that they need and having them work towards that as their primary goal. And people sometimes ask, well, what about supplements? Could I just take, you know, give you some pills so I make sure that I get the vitamins and the minerals and I eat what I want? Well, I remind them that most, we probably do not have all of the names for all of the micronutrients that our cells utilize in our processes. We've named quite a few, but there are probably thousands, if not millions, more that our bodies will use. And so food will have more micronutrients for healthy biochemistry than supplements. And then we have the problem of contamination and mislabeling. I'm sure most of you remember the melamine, the milk powder scandal in China, and the thousands of people who were ill and the hundreds who died. Most of our supplements are made in China. So I would be skeptical about the wisdom of relying on a supplement basis for restoring your micronutrient content. Food's going to be a better way to go. There are some things that might be helpful. And particularly in our folks who have the severe psychiatric problems, I will talk about a multivite, multimineral, B-complex, coenzyme Q. For anyone who has a mental health problem or an autoimmune problem, I also talk about omega-3s. A probiotic, I think it's helpful. You'll get far more shift in your gut by changing your diet. If you continue to eat a high grain, high sugar diet, the probiotics will not make much of a change. But when you first start the omega-3s, people have a lot of belching, gas, distress. Going through a bottle of probiotics will decrease those symptoms. So my food recommendations, and when I first go through it, the guys all go like, oh my God, you gotta be kidding. I tell them, this is going to be a journey. It will take you a while. It may take several weeks or several months to get through there. So I start off with, the goal is, once you're there, 9 cups of fruits and vegetables a day. You want to have 3 cups of bright colors for the antioxidants. You want to have 3 cups of green leaves. And in that green leaf category, I include the sulfur-rich foods. So that will be cabbage family, onion family, and mushrooms. And 3 more cups of other non-starchy fruits or vegetables. If you are diabetic, lean more on the vegetables for your bright colors than fruit. If you're not diabetic, fruit juice is fine. If you're diabetic, fruit juice is going to bring up a rush of your blood sugar, so whole fruit would be preferable. I also strongly advise that you minimize grains and minimize white potatoes, or at the very least, have none of those till you've had your 9 cups. And that's to decrease the inflammation. Also, in my experience, if you tell them, just get your 9 cups in, then eat what you want. That's a whole lot easier than saying stop. The CoQ, I'll come back to questions at the end. The CoQ, best sources for that are going to be organ meat, heart, tongue, gizzards, liver. I know I have guys say, look, doc, I'd rather go back to Iraq. So yes, you can get it. You can get it at Walgreens if you'd rather. Nuts and seeds and nutritional yeast are also some good sources there. And omega-3s, this is about fish. Let's see, I think that is maybe our next one. All right, we're going back. So the omega-3s, that is a fish oil. And in the fish oil, we can take about 40% of the omega-3s in fish oil and convert that over to the DHA, which is docosahexaenoic acid, and EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, and that is what's used in our cell membranes. It's critical for making myelin. If you take it in the form of hemp oil or in the form of flax oil, your body can convert about 10% of that over to EPA and DHA. If you take it in fish oil, you convert about 40%. Of the fish oil over to EPA, DHA. Another option is krill oil, which is the little tiny crustaceans that the salmon eat, and which is why the salmon are, you know, have a lovely pink orange color. It's because the krill are in this beautiful deep red. That is another source for omega-3s. The advantage of krill oil is that it's lower down in the food chain, so there's going to be less risk of mercury and heavy metal contamination. Now, the other advantage is that it has more phosphatidylcholine in it and more phospholipids, so that's a little more easily brought into our cell membranes. And I don't, unfortunately, I don't have a comparable conversion ratio like I do for the fish oil and flax oil. If you're going to buy that, the least expensive source that I'll be able to find would be www.vitacost, that's V-I-T-A, cost, C-O-S-T, .com. For the fish oil, because of concerns for heavy metal contaminations, my preference is to purchase pharmaceutical grade or a process called molecularly distilled. Krill oil, I'm a little less concerned about because, as I said, it's lower down on the food chain. For someone who has a neurological or psychological problem or a severe autoimmune problem such as rheumatoid arthritis, my style is to go with work them from 1 gram up to 4 grams, check their lipid profile. If their HDL is still below 45, continue moving up on the fish oil. You can take people all the way up to 8 grams. The hazard of going up is going to be an increased risk of bleeding. So if someone is already on baby aspirin, that probably one of the two are going to have to go away. You can't maximize fish oil in the presence of baby aspirin and have too much bleeding. Now, in the Eskimos, they eat the equivalent of probably 13 to 14 grams a day. They have trivial autoimmune illness, and they have a diet that is very, very high in fat. Most of their, in the traditional diet, most of their meal is raw fish or seal or whatever. They'll have seasonally a little bit of plant material, but that's only seasonal. But so they have a heavily meat or fish-based diet. They have, and if you give an Eskimo aspirin who's having a primitive diet, their bleeding time comes down remarkably because it blocks some of the effects from their high omega-3 diet. Omega-3s will shift your arachidonic acid pathways away from the inflammatory cytokines towards anti-inflammatory cytokines, which is why using 4 grams of fish oil can be a very potent anti-inflammatory. Okay, now there was a question that was trying to be asked in the back.
My question was maybe where are beans for this?
As in lentils, dals, etc. Okay, so the question, I'll repeat that. Where would legumes such as dal or beans and rice fit in? I would call that a protein source. I would certainly have some concerns that the beans and rice will shift our gut bacteria away from the gut bacteria that our ancestors had 50 and 60,000 years ago. Now, the hazard, it does not drive our insulin near as much, though, as simply having rice or flours. So there's less glycemic index problem. You'll still be at some risk for having difficulty with the bacteria that reside in the gut, and that problem has to do with the fact that bacteria and humans have had some kind of relationship for a million or so, several years, and we've learned how to detoxify the byproducts, and the bacteria have learned how to digest what it is that we normally eat. When we began eating grains and sugars, a different set of bacteria could grow in our gut and be dominant. We know that in rheumatoid arthritis, if you have more proteus in your gut, the severity of the inflammation, the severity of the disease, the rapidity of the decline is markedly increased. And that 40% of the people who have rheumatoid arthritis have proteus. If you get rid of the proteus, the severity of their symptoms decline. So the further, my take on all this is, the further our diet is away from green leaves, bright colors, and meat, the more likely we are to have bacteria in our gut to which our species is not familiar. And we are more likely to have gut bacteria then that will secrete toxins that our bodies have not yet learned how to detoxify and get rid of. So it's not my preferred. I think it's okay. My advice would be, I stress the green leaves, the bright colors, and if you're vegetarian, beans and rice would be your source of protein and see how it goes. If there's still a lot of problems with inflammation, autoimmune types of conditions, we could talk a little bit more afterwards and I'll give you some thoughts. Yes?
I just have a couple of quick questions. For the krill oil,
yes.
If someone has shellfish or allergy, can they still take it?
I do not know. The
which oil?
Krill oil.
Krill oil.
I would bet likely it would be a problem, and I would have them use 1 to 2 tablespoons of hemp oil or flax oil. And you know what I tell them is, make this dressing at home. Equal parts your omega-3 oil, either hemp or flax, lemon juice or lime juice, and then something, soy sauce or Bragg liquid aminos. Shake it up. Put whatever spices you want, and use that liberally on those 3 cups of greens I want you to have every day. And if you try to get 1 to 2 tablespoons of hemp oil that way, your body will convert it over.
I have a question about the source of tryptophan. You're mentioning the
organ meats.
Organ meats. For example, like liver, we're worried about liver is major positive for the heavy metals. So how can you overcome?
So, preference would be to buy organic meat. That would be helpful. If you're uncomfortable with liver, heart, tongue, gizzards are also very good sources for CoQ. And it, you know, it's wonderful. Cook it real slow, put some cloves in it, a little bit of vinegar, slice it, mince it small, stir in some taco seasonings or put it in spaghetti sauce. Serve it to your family. They have no idea. They just say, wow, that was great.
Tomato
sauce. It works. I'm very sneaky. I also have a yuck rule at my house. If you say yuck, it just means you aren't familiar with the taste and you need it 30 more times. So at my house, food is always good. So sometimes it's great, but nothing is ever bad. And my kids sort of have a lot of fun trying to get the other one to complain about something to see if they can make the other one have second servings. Yes. Let's see. I think I have a couple more. All right. So I have a series of lectures that I give, and I've been doing these down in Iowa City for the New Pioneer Co-op. I'm also teaching at the Kirkwood Community College. I'm coming up in November sometime, 5th, I think, for the Over 50 conference that the Kirkwood is sponsoring. I have a website, terrywalls.com. I have a small book which is explains the science and what I think is terms that my vets could understand, and has about 50 recipes in it. Mind you, my mitochondria that hopefully will be coming back from the printer in a couple of maybe in a week. And I have these lectures on the CD with electronic copy of the book as well, for anyone who's wanting something more right now. This is the mitochondria. We talked about that. A little more quick detail on the nutrients. Food sources for the nutrients. Nutritional yeast is among the best that you're going to find. Dark greens and mushrooms. Coenzyme Q that we covered. Wheat germ and nutritional yeast. The organ meats. Antioxidants, bright colors, which is what I explained to my vets. And you want to have 3 different colors, if at all possible. Lipoic acid and carnitine, which help the mitochondria bring in alternative food sources. More bright beans and actually organ meat. And game meats. People are hunters or fishermen. Fish have to worry about the contaminations of our rivers. but if there are hunters, that's fine. Resveratrol, think the black fruits and berries that are out there, elderberries, wild grapes, black grapes. Black mulberry trees are tremendous sources of resveratrol. And organic sulfur in the cabbage and onion family. Omega-3s, I think we've covered this. You might want to mention to your parents that their kids' teeth will be greatly straighter if they see to it their kids are getting omega-3s in their diet. So for the kids, adding freshly ground flax meal or hemp seed into their cereals and casseroles will go a long way to preventing orthodontic bills. Okay, food sources, if you're having problems, think about adding probiotic when you start the omega-3s. Neurotransmitters, people with chronic pain, depression, we're now realizing they have a deficiency of GABA. GABA, aminobutyric acid, which is highly dependent on organic sulfur. N-acetylcysteine is our least expensive way of supplementing, improving that. Eating more organic sulfur, as in garlic, onions, cabbages. Myself personally, I probably eat 300 to 600 grams of kale or collards every day. And if I do not, I can perceive within 48 hours a decline in energy and a marked drop in my strength. Okay, so here's some more food sources. We've got those in your handout for you. Minerals, magnesium, selenium are very important, as I said earlier. We are short on our mineral content in our diet. Spices that can help with GABA is turmeric. Iodine is also very important. I've mentioned that we are short on our iodine. Things that lower GABA, you've probably heard from your patients that some of them aspartame causes severe headaches and jitteriness, and MSG, monosodium glutamate, used in restaurant cooking and in Chinese food, also can increase glutamate, depress GABA. My advice then is anyone who has neurological problems or psychological problems to avoid aspartame and to avoid MSG. Crooked teeth, we already talked about. It would decrease, or say, low omega-3s are associated with learning disabilities, aggressive behavior, behavior problems, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and autism in our kids. Good reason to try and help our moms understand the importance of trying to find a way to have their kids get a tablespoon of that hemp seed or flax seed every day.
Just a quick question about the fish oil.
Yes.
For 4 grams of fish oil, like what's the recommended amount of vitamin E recommended to take to prevent the oil being oxidized?
60 units.
60 units of mixed vitamin E?
Of mixed vitamin E. If you will do, see to it that they're having nuts and seeds every day, there'll be a lot of vitamin E in those nuts and seeds. But some of the vitamin, the fish oil supplements have the vitamin E already added into the fish oil, so you could look for that as well.
What's the dose of fish oil for children and how are they going to manage that?
Well, I can give you the adults for the dose for adults. I don't have as clear data information for the kids. So for an adult with a neurological or psychological issue, or a severe autoimmune problem, I start with 1 gram and have them titrate up to 4 grams. I will then check at the lipid profile and see where their HDL is at. I want to have the HDL well up over 40. If I can, I'll try and get it up to 60. And I will continue to increase the fish oil until that HDL is up to 60. With the caveat being, if they are on aspirin for their heart disease or their stroke prophylaxis, it's not going to work. And then I'm going to have a conversation with whoever is prescribing the aspirin about negotiating which dose we're going to try and push. For the equivalents of flax oil or hemp oil, 2 grams of fish oil equals 1 tablespoon of hemp or flax oil. And in my house, we have all of our salad dressings. I'm basically making the hemp oil, lime juice, soy sauce combination. And we use that on all of our greens. So finding, you can't fry with omega-3 oils, they'll break down. You're going to have to use them strictly as a salad dressing type of oil. Okay, DJD, the joint structures, the tendons, the cartilage, are all very dependent on sulfur and N-acetylcysteine. There are several studies that have shown us replacing more, adding 2 grams of N-acetylcysteine in the setting of acute trauma to the joint greatly reduces the risk of future DJD. Some of the biochemists, basic scientists at Iowa, are studying chondrocytes and stunning them, which would normally kill them off. But if they bathe them with a solution rich in N-acetylcysteine, the chondrocytes don't die. So, if you don't want to get DJD, encourage increased consumption of sulfur-rich foods. 3 cups a day. And bone broth, something that I advocate, you take some, when you get your meat, get in the bone, save the bones at the end. Don't worry about what if your kids have been chewing on them. Just put them in the pot, put a couple tablespoons of vinegar in the pot, simmer it for 2 to 24 hours. The vinegar will draw the minerals out, so you get more calcium, magnesium, zinc, boron, vanadium. The trace minerals necessary for healthy bones will be in the broth. You'll have some of the glutamine and collagen, which is also necessary for ligaments and bones. And so a cup of the bone broth will have more nutritional help for your joints than glucosamine chondroitin. Our great grandmothers knew that you needed to have, you know, a hearty bowl of soup every day. They were right.
What kind of bone do you recommend?
Well, any, just not your own.
Just not.
Or your children's.
The chicken, the drumstick would not be a good source, right?
Oh, the drumstick is fine.
But you think the bone from cow or beef would be better?
No, I think they're all fine. You know, and variety is a good thing. So I buy all our meat with bones. I save the bones. If I don't have time to make the bone soup, I just put them in a Ziploc bag, put them in the freezer. And then the other thing I do, I go to the refrigerator, open up, do I have any vegetables that look like I really don't want to eat them anymore because they get sort of stale and yucky or maybe whatever. I just put them in my bone broth, simmer them for 24 hours, and I use the strainer, strain out the bone, strain out the vegetables. I'll go to my spice cabinets. People remember parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Mm-hmm. Any of those spices, any others that you like, put those in. So we're discovering that more and more of these spices are potent anti-inflammatories. Strain. You're probably short of iodine, so have some powdered kelp or powdered seaweed, put that in. 24 hours later, strain, discard the spent vegetables in your bones, and you can use that broth then, a cup of broth, and you could blend it with a cooked potato, cooked yams, slice a few mushrooms, and you have a lovely cup of soup, incredibly good for your joints. And if you've added a bunch of your powdered kelp in there, now it has lots of iodine, which your body's been starving for. It's really good for you. Then instead of stir-frying with oil, I'll stir-fry with a couple tablespoons of my bone broth, because there's a little bit of fat in it. It ends up being healthier overall.
How about the bone marrow? Because
bone marrow, yes.
He's a primitive man. Indication that he sucked up the bone marrow.
Yes,
the bone marrow is the greatest source of DHA, EPA that you're going to find. So your brain would love it if you suck out active bone marrow. You know, when you look at what our children are eating, they're eating so badly. Their brains are on fire. They are starved for. Their brains are very short on myelin, so the brain is saying, I am starved for good fat. I need more fat. The brain is on fire from all of the free radicals from the poor nutrition. So the brain is saying, oh my God, I need antioxidants. Go find some berries, please. And our children instead are going to the vending machine, getting their fat craving with omega-6 fats, which are pro-inflammatory. They're still starving for their myelin. And they're making more inflammation and creating more sugar cravings. So we're in a very negative feedback for our children.
Speaking of that, what do you think about high fructose corn syrup?
High fructose corn syrup
is subsidized by the U.S. government. There's no subsidies for fresh
fruits and vegetables. Well, I could. The question was, what do I think of high fructose corn syrup? I think it's a problem. My first attention with my patients, though, is get your 9 cups of fruits and vegetables. When you have that one down, come back and we'll talk some more. I'll do things incrementally. If I start stressing over high fructose corn syrup, which is a problem, I may not ever get people past the 9 cups of fruits and vegetables. You know, and when I hear the conversations now about the critical need for healthcare reform, it's my firm belief that we could throw our whole gross domestic product into healthcare reform. They'd give us universal access, free medicines, and we would be steadily more ill unless we address these nutritional concepts, get them to our children, get them to our adults, get them to all of us. Until we understand that we have to eat green leaves and bright colors, abandon the sugars, greatly, greatly reduce the grains, the physical degeneration is going to continue. We cannot spend enough money to fix all of our ills if we will not give ourselves the substrates they need for all those biochemical reactions. Okay, so how do you afford it? You've got this in your handout. The basic thing is grow a garden, easy things to grow, chives, parsley, green leaves. You can go wild. Elderberries will be coming in soon. They're quite wonderful. Talked about the bone powder supplements. Use food, please, not supplements. Big things that I do suggest, B-complex, the multivite, multi-mineral, fish oil, and sunscreen. For the sun, you gotta be careful about sunscreen. People stay inside, they put sunscreen on when they go outside. We've now made an epidemic of vitamin D deficiency. So I check levels and see to it people have enough vitamin D. 2,000 units every day at a minimum.
Get 2,000
everyone? You know, I like to check a level to know where I'm at. If you're severely low, 2,000 will not get you there.
No, you have to go to monitoring.
You have to go probably up to 10,000.
We've done the 50,000 weekly, and then I usually have them on 1 or 2 a day, and then recheck.
That's right.
Because I have people that have 4.
And if you do 2,000, you will not. While it's safe, you'll get into trouble. If you're deficient, you will not catch up. Some more references, Institute for Functional Medicine. They teach this biochemistry. They have a number of great CME products. I recommend them very highly. The Center for Mind-Body Medicine also has a number of educational products, which I could recommend very highly. The World's Healthiest Foods is a cookbook by George Madelgen, which I do recommend to my patients. And then my website, you can send people to as well. Any other questions? I know it's now a few minutes after 1. I'd be happy to stay and keep talking with anyone who wants to. What was that?
Did you have time off of your slide? Thank you.